me up and carried me into the sun and back to the water where I didn't cry. I'm sure I didn't cry. Amanda. Once Maddie and Ruth and I settled on the island, whenever I wasn't sleeping like a dead woman, I was a virtual whirlwind. I'll say that for myself. All through that April and May and into June, I pushed my trouble out of my mind and put the island in order. I tilled the garden and planted the seeds along the rows Ruth and I lined up with string. I made out the grocery lists and collected the deliveries from the locker, even the chunks of ice for the icebox. They were heavy, but I dragged them up the hill on a blanket. I washed Ruth's pinafores and combed her hair and taught her how to count to 20 and saw that she kept her shoes on and stayed well back from the water. Mostly, I watched while she played her endless games to make sure that the stones and twigs stayed out of her eyes, her doll stayed decently dressed, and her face stayed reasonably clean. Matilda did all these things too, of course, but she did them less seriously and with less zeal. She was always wandering off to write a letter to Carl or to stick her nose in one of the books with which she'd weighted our sled. Now that the weather was warm, often she'd let Ruthie play right at the edge of the water while she read, and I worried that she wouldn't notice the difference between the plop of Ruth's pebbles and the splash of the child herself falling in. One night, when the moon was so bright that it made a ghostly day, I awoke to the sound of splashing and Ruth's squeals. Terrified, I rushed down to the shore. Matilda was holding Ruth by the arms and spinning her around as fast as she could, dragging the little girl through the water, while the moonlight licked the waves around them like a flame. "Stop that! Stop that right now!" I stamped my foot. Matilda stopped spinning and turned to face me, drawing Ruth against her body as she did so, her arms wrapped around the child's middle, so that Ruth's feet dangled, dripping over the water. Ruth wasn't big enough, though, to cover Matilda's nakedness. I was shocked. The two of them there like that, without a stitch on, where anyone could see, I couldn't think where to put my eyes. I turned and hurried back to the house and felt my way down the dark hall to my room. I lay on my bed, my hands pressed one over the other on my chest to calm my racing heart. Then I let my hands slide down. I let myself feel through the thin cotton of my nightgown, the part that had begun to swell like bread dough. I tried, as I had for weeks now, to push it down, but it was solid. It would not budge. And then, inside of me, it fluttered. "Stand still. These are sticking together." Amanda was trying to wrap Ruth's hair around a handful of burrs. "Good. Just like a witch," she cackled to make it a game, and Ruth giggled. "And now, a little of this on your cheeks." Gently, she smeared rouge on Ruth's soft skin. "Not too much. Now, you remember what we practiced?" Ruth nodded. "All right, under the covers and close your eyes. And remember, not a word, no matter what he asks you." Amanda was keeping Ruth out of school as long as possible. No one had argued with her that first year after she'd been released from St. Michael's. Ruth was only 5, after all, and what with the months of not speaking and the toilet accidents, she hardly seemed ready for kindergarten. The next year, though, had been more difficult. She'd had to remind Carl that he knew nothing about children, that he could not imagine the trauma Ruth had suffered at losing her mother, that she was teaching the child more than any school would have. The last part, at least, was true. Ruth, although she wasn't a wizard with arithmetic as Amanda had been, could already add and subtract, and although she hated the cruel Struwelpeter, she could read every word about him. She could identify trees by their leaves and birds by their calls, and could point out at least 4 constellations. She understood that blue and yellow made green, knew how to differentiate a Guernsey from a Jersey, and had raised a lamb whose mother had died of distemper. Carl was fairly easy to persuade, but Amanda knew Ruth's precocity wouldn't impress the school board. When that body sent someone to the house to investigate, she pretended that Ruth was ill and even staged a convincing epileptic fit. "Perhaps you'd better wait in the front room, Mr. Schmidt," Amanda said calmly as Ruth, her tongue lolling from her lips, began to jerk and then to bark. It had worked wonderfully the first time, but this year Carl, who'd left a pair of pliers in his room, came home to find the school board member on the davenport. "It's very sad about your daughter," Mr. Schmidt said. "I'd hope she'd be better this year." When she heard Carl running up the stairs, Amanda realized there was nothing more that she could do. Ruth would have to go to school. Part 2 Chapter 8 It was a morning ripe with the smell of manure, an odor acrid when it first penetrated the nostrils, but compelling and pleasant like a good cheese the longer it clung to the air. The school and its playground were bordered by fields, all freshly spread and drying in the warm September wind. On a hillock at the west end of the playground, 12 girls had settled. Most with their legs crossed, Indian style, skirts pushed to the ground in the space between their thighs, cradling their dinner pails. In the cluster was the entire female enrollment of Lake Ridge School, with the exception of Ruth Newman, who always ate her lunch alone. A few who had finished eating leaned back on locked elbows, tilting their chins to catch the last of the year's sun. At the crown of the hill sat Imogene Lindgren, her knees crooked together, legs angling off to one side in imitation of older girls. At 8 3/4, Imogene already gave clear indications that she was to become a woman, and although none of her girlfriends, nor even Imogene herself, could have defined this quality, they all studied her carefully, as if she were one step ahead in the game. For the boys, too, Imogene was mesmerizing. And almost without knowing they did so, two or three would always be circling and circling, making tentative forays toward her and then drawing quickly back or veering off toward one of her retinue, a safer target. "Watch this! Watch this!" one demanded, darting up and poking her in the shoulder with the tip of his finger. Then he rolled his eyelid until it was inside out and glistening red above the eyeball, turning his head this way and that to give the widest audience a chance to admire. Delighted shrieks and groans rose up. Several girls, giggling, threw their hands over their faces, and one, who had been seated on the slope of the hill, tumbled over sideways. Imogene was not beyond this sort of pleasure, but she knew better than to express it, and instead rolled her own eyes in disgust and put the last bite of her ham sandwich into her mouth. A small knot of boys, seeing that an emissary had paved their way, then approached. Imogene watched them out of the corner of her eye as she finished her pickles, neatly folded the waxed paper that had kept the sandwich from soaking in brine, and wiped her fingers on the clean white handkerchief that her mother had edged in lace. Among the younger children, the popular game of the last few weeks had been a version of hide-and-go-seek and tag, boys against the girls. It was understood that whoever was caught might have to submit to a kiss or reveal a glimpse of underpants, although the unwilling on either side could, without too much difficulty, delay this prize until the bell rang to rescue them. Leaving their pails in a row by the school wall, the girls went off to find hiding places in the count of 100. By 40, Imogene had observed with increasing dissatisfaction that each bush and corner on the playground had been inhabited so often that it was marked by a telltale path of trampled dust. By 50, she gave up looking for a place where she couldn't be found, and instead ran to the 3 concrete culverts that had been left over from a drainage project and were now abandoned in one corner of the playground, like a ruined shrine to some forgotten god. This sort of hiding place was more to her liking anyway, since from one of the tunnels she could leap out easily and turn the tables, becoming the aggressor. On 60, she crawled into the first tunnel and immediately scrambled out, horrified by the crooked, unbroken trails of ants that covered its floor. The second tunnel, as it turned out, was already inhabited, but Imogene crouched at the entrance for a moment, peering in. Ruth Newman was a mess, as usual. Her fine hair had pulled halfway out of her braid on one side, so that it bulged in a snarled mass over her ear, and the hem of her skirt was coming down. She was so blatantly odd that she'd been a scapegoat almost from the first week she appeared in school 4 years before. Even Imogene had occasionally joined her schoolmates when they felt particularly mean and taunting Ruth, usually about her upper right incisor, which was dead at the root and rotted to the gray of pencil lead, a baby tooth that clung to her gum although the girl was 11. Many a dull lesson had been whiled away by sketching a face with a wide grin, shading in the appropriate tooth, labeling the modified drawing Ruth, and, when the teacher's back was turned, holding up the ingenious creation for general viewing. Ruth rarely seemed even to notice, or would quietly look at the perpetrators and those who laughed, not with reproach, but with curiosity, as if she saw something unnatural in their faces. This experience was at first disturbing, but ultimately boring, and eventually only those who could find no other means of maintaining their status punctured her solitude. In the culvert, Ruth was simply sitting, examining the pocked surface of the concrete and enjoying its coolness through the thin cotton of her skirt. Whenever her body warmed an area, she shifted to another cool spot. A few lines of ants marched around her, but she didn't seem to mind. From time to time, she shot a clay marble from the small handful in her pocket through the tunnel, with just enough force so that it rolled to the edge but did not fall over. Imogene was not only queen of the second and third grades, but also marble champion of the entire school, or at least she and everyone else believed she was. But here is what she saw when she looked into the tunnel. A blue mib, very slightly lopsided, rolling slowly, slowly, slowly to the edge of the tunnel, where it gently nicked a brown mib and then lay still. In other words, she saw a marble shooter who could beat her. This didn't upset her. Imogene appreciated skill, especially if she could make use of it. She duck-walked into the culvert's entrance, blocking most of the light. Ruth glanced up at her but didn't move. "What are you doing there?" Imogene asked. Ruth didn't answer, but she looked down at her hand and rolled another marble, slowly, 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 to the edge of the concrete tunnel. Offended, Imogene forgot her attempt at condescension. "Look, you're shooting marbles," she said, slapping one palm against the tunnel floor. "I can see you're shooting marbles. Why don't you just say so?" "If you can see I'm shooting marbles, why do you want me to say so?" Ruth said to the cool concrete beside her hand. And then she squinted up at Imogene, dark against the hard, bright blue of the sky, and smiled, showing her black tooth full to the world. Imogene's fingers stung where they'd hit the concrete. She narrowed her eyes for a moment, hesitating, and then she let her anger evaporate. Forgetting about her hiding place, oblivious to the ants, Imogene crawled into the tunnel beside Ruth and explained her excellent plan. Imogene coveted an Aggie as blue as the sky at noon. This marble had somehow come to be in the clutches of Bert Weiss, at 8, already a swaggering, self-satisfied boy who picked his nose often and in public. Imogene wanted that marble for herself, but she'd also become convinced that she had a duty to free it from the fat, greasy sack of marbles that Bert kept in his desk. So far, she'd gone about her quest in the wrong way, as it turned out. She'd practiced for months and pumped an older boy she knew already in seventh grade and tired of marbles for his secrets. A lick of saliva on the finger for certain shots, shoulders positioned a particular way for others. Her skirts had become permanently brownish at the hems and across the front from squatting and kneeling in the dirt to shoot. She'd become good, then better and better, collecting many other children's prize marbles along the way, until her own supple cowhide marble bag was stuffed nearly full. In these early games, the blue marble had appeared often among the brown mibs and the green and red and yellow crystals and the rainbow swirlies and the cat's eyes. But Bert, ever vigilant for opportunities to thwart another's pleasure, began to notice Imogene's interest in that particular sphere. And when her aim improved, he pulled it out of the game. Pulled it out of the game, just like that. Just like that, it was gone. Dropped into the limp gray bag, and he tugged the drawstring tight, squeezing out the fresh air as she watched. He would not take it out again. But now she had a plan. "Hey, Bert," she whispered to the greased hair in front of her the next day, as Miss Crawley began her scratchy litany about the letters that go above the line and the letters that go below the line in cursive script. "Marbles today at recess. Got it?" "Nah, marbles is for kids," Bert said into his shoulder. "No, I've got a good idea. We'll play teams." Miss Crawley turned from the series of L's she'd been admiring on the board. "Who is talking? I will have no talking while I am talking. Do you understand that, pupils?" She turned back to the board. "Now, the L should not be confused with the I, which comes only to the halfway point and, of course, has the dot. Now, I do not want to see any more of those large scribbled dots above your eyes. There's no need to make a rat's nest. What is called for here is simply the touching of pencil to paper. Like this." She made a series of small taps with the chalk across the top of her row of letters. Some of them did not show up. "You see?" she said. Ahead of Imogene, Bert shrugged his acquiescence to her suggestion, just as Miss Crawley turned, smiling to the class. Her smile dropped from her face. Bert, you are driving me pretty near to the end of my rope. Do you have something to share with the rest of the class? The plan played out just as Imogene had intended. She let Bert choose his own partner, Otto Schmidt, and then she told him to pick a partner for her as well. He scanned the group of onlookers, rapidly dividing the good players from those who could hardly balance a marble between finger and thumb, and then he saw Ruth, standing perhaps just a little bit closer than she ordinarily would, chewing a hangnail and looking down at her shoes, apparently hoping to be part of the group without being noticed. Imogene's heart jumped a little as she saw his eyes squint with triumphant glee. "There! She's your partner. Ruth the Tooth. Let's play." The blue Aggie lay trapped in the bag at first, and Imogene had trouble concentrating on the game because of it. Even without meaning to, she made several poor shots right at the start and sacrificed an apricot cat's eye, one of her favorites, to the greasy pouch. Ruth bungled every shot admirably, just as Imogene had instructed. She seemed unable to keep the shooter from slipping out of her hand and kept catching her heel in the hem of her skirt when she tried to kneel. At last, their performance encouraged Bert's maliciousness to get the better of his caution, and he produced the blue marble. "Ain't she pretty?" he observed, shining the orb on his yellowed shirt front. "What will you give me to put this one in the game?" "A nickel," Imogene said promptly. "You ain't got a nickel." "I have two." "Show me, then." "I can get one." "Ha! 50 years from now. No, I'm thinking I should get something better than to risk this beauty." Imogene seethed. The marble meant nothing to him. This was pure meanness. "Well, what do you want, then?" "I want," he looked around and licked his narrow lips. "I want the black tooth," he stared at Ruth. Somebody snorted a laugh. Somebody else made a retching sound and was rewarded with a wash of giggles. Imogene looked at Ruth. For a minute she hesitated, seeing out of the corner of her eye the blue marble glowing with hope in Bert's hand. Then she said, "Forget it, that's ridiculous." She reached to pick up her remaining marbles from the circle. "Wait," Ruth said. "I'll do it. See, it's ready for pulling anyway." She parted her lips to move the tooth back and forth with her tongue. "You shouldn't," Imogene said. "It's not right." "It's my tooth," Ruth said. "I can do what I want with it." And then she smiled at Imogene, as broadly and brilliantly as she had smiled from the culvert. "Let's play." "Tooth first," Bert said. But just then Miss Crawley came into the yard ringing the bell. "After school," Bert said, and dropped the blue marble into his bag and drew the drawstring tight. When they were finally released into the September afternoon, a gray layer of cloud had thickened the smell of manure to a pungent miasma. Ruth was among the last out of the building, and the children who had gathered several yards from the door had begun to punch each other lightly about the arms and kick each other a little about the ankles by the time she appeared. They quieted immediately and watched as she drew from her dress pocket a piece of string she had stolen from the supply cabinet while Miss Crawley's attention was focused on the third grade's times tables. Tying it on the little tooth was difficult. It slipped off several times before she was satisfied that it was secure. But at last she declared herself ready and walked over to the tool school shed, the string dangling from her mouth. "Ain't you afraid it's going to hurt?" a small girl asked at her elbow. "Not too much. I worked it during arithmetic," Ruth answered as she opened the shed door. She had to kneel to tie the string around the handle. "Now, who's going to slam this?" she asked, looking at Imogene. Imogene hesitated. The thought of yanking that tooth out of Ruth's gum made her feel sick. But Ruth continued to look at her steadily. Finally, Imogene took a deep breath and grabbed the door. "You ready?"
"Ready."
Imogene inhaled again and held her breath. Ruth's eyes were still wide upon her, but Imogene squinted her own eyes until they were nearly closed. Then she slammed the door as hard as she could into its frame. The blood was everywhere. It seemed to be spurting in all directions, running out of Ruth's mouth and all over her dress. Without thinking, Imogene produced her handkerchief and pushed it into Ruth's right hand. As Ruth looked blankly down at it, a few drops of blood seeped from between the fingers of the hand that she was holding to her lips and stained the white cloth red. She glanced in alarm at Imogene, who looked slightly disgusted. "Use it," Imogene said impatiently, and Ruth stuffed the handkerchief into the raw space. The tooth dangled from the door handle, pearly gray and red from where it had yanked free. Ruth untied it and then polished it with a clean corner of the hanky. "Here," she said, handing it to Bert. "Let's play." Winning the marble was easy. One quick flick of Ruth's shooter and it was out of the circle, out of the game, and no one was much interested after that. Imogene felt in her chest an overwhelming desire to run home as quickly as she could and sit beside her mother on the long, low sofa in the front room. But she gritted her teeth and walked beside Ruth, for their way lay in the same direction. As they walked, Ruth pressed her tongue into the newly empty space, and Imogene rolled and rolled the blue marble between her fingers in her pocket. It felt heavy and tainted. She drew it out, half expecting its color to be blotted, but the blue glowed on, indifferent to the blood that had been spilled in its winning. "Here, let's see once." Ruth held out her hand. Imogene hesitated a moment, and then put the Aggie in the center of Ruth's palm. Ruth plucked it out between the thumb and index finger of her left hand and turned toward the sun. She held the marble in front of one eye while she shut the other. "Look, you can see right in there." "Give it here," Imogene said, and Ruth passed the globe back to her. Ruth was right. You could see into it. Imogene studied the layers of deeper blue that ran through it, and a small cloud of lighter color that drifted near one edge. "I'm going to keep this forever," Imogene said. "Feel how smooth?" She held it against Ruth's cheek and rolled it slowly upward with her palm. They walked on, stopping now and again to look into the marble from a new angle, handing it back and forth, blinking as the sun filled their eyes. "My mother says your mother is dead," Imogene said. She glanced at Ruth out of the corner of her eye, not knowing how the other girl would respond. "Did you cry when someone mentioned your dead mother?" But Ruth was busy polishing the marble on the hem of her dress and hardly seemed to care. "Yes." Emboldened, Imogene pursued the issue. It was interesting, after all. She couldn't think of anyone else she knew who didn't have a mother. "How did she die?" "She drowned." "In the lake?" "Of course. Where else would a person drown?" "Well, there's other water than Nagawaki Lake, you know." "Well, that's where she drowned, anyway. In Nagawaki Lake." Imogene had the marble back again, and she rubbed it between her palms before asking an even more daring question. "Did you see when it happened?" Ruth thought about this for a moment. "I guess so," she said finally. "I drowned, too." "That's stupid. If you drowned, you'd be dead. Sometimes you die, sometimes you don't. That must be how it is with drowning." Ruth said this with such authority that Imogene felt her own position, as the one who knew the most, who was most interesting, who would clearly be the one to say which answer was right and which game was played and for how long, slipping. "My mother found me in the garden, like in the Green Fairy book," she countered. "Really?" Ruth seemed suitably impressed, and Imogene felt generous again. "You sure are going to look better when that tooth comes in," she said. Not knowing what to say to this, Ruth threw the marble up and caught it. Imogene gasped. "Don't lose it." "Don't worry," Ruth said, tossing it up once more to prove she could. When she caught it, she handed it back to Imogene, who slipped it into her pocket. They had reached Imogene's turnoff. "Well," she said, "I guess I'll be seeing you tomorrow." "Wait a minute." Ruth reached into her pocket. "Here." She held out the gory handkerchief. "How about washing it?" Imogene said, leaning a little away from the thing. Ruth looked at the handkerchief and nodded, as if noticing for the first time that it was soiled, and then began to fold it carefully. Imogene, watching, amended her words. "You can keep it." "Are you sure?" "Of course. I've got plenty." "So long, then." Imogene walked on a few steps toward her house and then turned back. Ruth was still standing in the road, watching her. "Ruth," Imogene called. "You want this?" She drew the marble out of her pocket and held it up. "No, it's yours. See you tomorrow." Imogene waved and half ran, half skipped with her delight in her treasure all the way home. Ruth, on the other hand, was in no hurry. Had Imogene looked again, she would have seen Ruth turn and start back toward the school. She walked with her chin very high, placing one foot carefully in front of the other, as if she were balancing something on her head. By the time she reached the playground, the sun had begun to set in crimson streaks, and the manure had mellowed in the cool of the evening, so that it now just seasoned the air with a hint of organic richness. She returned to the culverts and chose again the one in which Imogene had found her that morning. This time, however, she took a running start and tried to hurl herself on top of the concrete cylinder. On the first try, she didn't jump high enough to reach the summit and slipped back to earth, grazing her elbow slightly on the way down. On the second try, her footing was off and she veered away at the last moment. On the third try, she ran so fast that she could not keep track of her steps, planted her feet hard in the dust about a foot from the tunnel, and flew into the air, spinning her body as she went so that she landed smack, sitting nearly at the top. She had only to grip hard with her thighs and wriggle her way upward, and she was there. Inching up as she pressed against the concrete, had pulled her dress tight across her throat, and she leaned first to the left and then to the right to loosen it. Then she crossed her ankles, one over the other. Despite the overcast afternoon, the concrete had soaked in enough sunlight to warm the backs of her legs. For a moment, she leaned back until her body draped over the curving tunnel and looked at the playground upside down. If she concentrated very hard, she could almost believe that the trees and honeysuckle hung from a green sky, and that the orange and red rivers of the sunset flooded over a periwinkle ground. But soon the blood throbbed in her head and her skinned elbow began to sting. She sat up, spit a little on her fingers, and rubbed the sore spot with the pink saliva. Ruth smoothed her skirt neatly over her knees, and then drew the lace-trimmed handkerchief from her pocket and smoothed it over the skirt. It was a little stiff where the blood had dried, but she was able to press it fairly flat. Delicately, she pinched the lace edges between her first two fingers and thumbs and set the crown on her head. Sitting tall upon her throne, she gazed at the empty playground rolling out before her. Chapter 9. It had worked out all right. They had made do. That was what Amanda could hardly get over every morning, when she woke to the sound of Carl's chair scraping on the wooden floor as he got dressed to go out to the milking. He never could keep from moving that chair, she thought fondly. It was almost as if he wanted her to know he was up and their day was beginning. There had been that year or two of wondering who would stay and how exactly things would be arranged, but somehow they'd settled into a family at last. The various tasks of life divided comfortably among them, and the days now turned like a wheel with three spokes. So that even though Carl had been distracted lately, Amanda and Ruth simply shifted themselves to accommodate his moods. Joe had begun to visit regularly, ever since the day Carl invited him to dinner, and on Friday nights he escorted Amanda to the pictures and a fish fry. They felt an affection for one another based on their old love and sustained by avoiding personal conversation. If he'd hoped for something more, he never hinted at it, except to ask occasionally if Amanda would go out on a Saturday. She never would. Saturday was the night she and Carl listened to their programs on the radio. All this would have been enough, really, more than enough, but then Ruth had found Imogene, too. The first time Ruth mentioned Imogene, the night she'd come home with blood smeared on her cheeks, Amanda had felt her own blood drain away. She was tempted. She could feel the retort coming to her tongue. There's no Imogene. You can't know an Imogene. But of course there was, and Ruth did. You ruined this dress, Amanda had said instead, pulling the garment a little too roughly over the girl's head. I doubt I'll be able to get this out. Imogene says the fairies brought her. Ruth's voice was muffled by the fabric over her mouth. Amanda bent over the pump to hide her face. That's just a story, Ruth, she said. Carl wasn't interested in fairies either. He put one hand on Ruth's forehead, the other on her chin, and tilted her head back to study her gums. Here, he said, wetting his handkerchief with the contents of a bottle he kept behind the flour bin. This'll make it better. Ruth frowned at the taste, but she held her jaw steady and let her father minister to her. It wasn't accurate, of course, to say that Ruth had found Imogene. Imogene had been there all along, as Amanda well knew, for after she was released from St. Michael's, she often went into the bait shop to assure herself that the child was showing no signs of the inauspicious way she'd come into the world. Although she understood the safety of her secret, depended upon holding herself as far as possible from the girl. She couldn't seem to help drawing near. Mary Louise would push Imogene forward for Amanda to admire, but at the same time would hold tight to her shoulder. "Hasn't she grown? Jeannie, you know Miss Starkey. Say, how do you do?" But Imogene would hang back as if in obedience to a message she felt through her mother's fingers. When Ruth started school, Amanda found herself in town more often. She was in the shop one day in March when Imogene was feeling weak and dizzy, and she was the first to realize that the girl had scarlet fever. She insisted that she be quarantined along with the Lindgrens, although the doctor might have been persuaded to let her go home. "We can't risk infecting Ruth," she declared, brushing aside Mary Louise's protestations. "Besides, Imogene needs me. I haven't forgotten my training." Imogene's illness scared Amanda so much that she could hardly catch her breath when she thought of what might happen. But once the real danger had passed, she wished her recovery would go on forever. She cut paper dolls for the little girl, not just the kind that stood stiff and simple, joined at the hands like a fence, but also shapes that resembled real women who could model clothes Amanda cut from the catalogs. Ruth had never been interested in the just-looking, the just-laying-out of paper dolls, but Imogene loved it. "Look," Imogene announced to her mother one evening, swatting aside the pillow slip Mary Louise was mending and climbing onto her lap with a sheet of paper in her hands. Amanda had drawn whiskers on the girl's face and colored the tip of her nose black. "Miss Starkey taught me to write my numbers." "Those are beautiful, darling," Mary Louise said. But that night, she had a talk with Amanda. "I'm taking Jeannie back to the shop with me tomorrow. It isn't fair, our keeping you from Ruth and Carl like this, and I think she's well enough now. I mean, thanks to you, she's completely recovered. I don't know what we would have done without you, Mandy. I was so worried. But everything's all right now, isn't it?" So Imogene went off the next morning with her hand in her mother's, and Amanda went back to the farm. She didn't stop visiting, though, and Mary Louise was always pleased to show her daughter off. "Amanda, you should hear the way Imogene can do her sums. What's 5 plus 7, Jeannie?" And later, "What's 5 times 7, Jeannie?" And later still, "What's 5 times 7 plus 75 minus 57? Until the numbers were so quick and complicated that only Amanda and Imogene knew the answers. As Imogene got older, it would have been natural for Amanda to encourage a friendship between the girls, but she did not. Something alarmed her about Imogene, something that made her feel it was too risky to bring them together. She'd noticed it one Sunday morning when she'd stood across the street, watching the family emerge from church, Imogene riding on her father's shoulders. The girl looked exactly like Matilda. "That'll be 15 cents, please," Imogene said in her most grown-up voice. She'd hoisted herself onto a stool behind the counter in her mother's bait shop so that she could reach the register. "Arthur, have you got a nickel?" the man asked the boy who stood beside him. "I'll pay you back when we get home." "That's all right," the boy said. "You gave it to me in the first place." His hair fell forward over his glasses as he reached into his pocket. "My son and I are thinking of starting a tour boat company at Nagawaki Beach," the man said. "If there was a boat that drove around the lake, would you girls ride on it?" "Dad," Arthur said. He shuffled his feet in embarrassment and looked at the floor. "Nagawaki Beach is too far," Ruth said. "But it would stop for you anywhere around the lake and bring you back again." "Just going around in a circle?" Imogene said. "A big circle, all the way around the lake. And it would be a nice boat, 2 decks and a mahogany rail, red velvet seat cushions, or maybe a nautical stripe."
"I like the red," Imogene said. "Would there be food?"
"There could be. That's a good idea. Don't you think that's a good idea, Arthur?" "Yes," the boy said politely.
"Shouldn't we be getting home, though?"
After the door had closed behind them, Imogene said, "You know the big white house with the pillars, down the road from the Franciscans? That's theirs." Everyone who'd ever been on the lake knew the house with the pillars. The White House, certain people said, smiling snidely behind their martinis as they cruised by. But it drew them, nevertheless. "Who'd have thought there'd be so much money in swamps?" they said, referring to the Florida land boom, which had made the Owens's fortune secure. Not so much because Clement Owens, like every man and his brother, had known when to get in,
but because he'd known when to get out. Imogene propped her head on one hand, sighed, and sifted aimlessly with the other through a box of lead sinkers. Ruth kept an eye on her as she drifted around the shop, examining the merchandise. Tubs of night crawlers and leeches, tanks of minnows, coils of line, baskets of red and white cork bobbers. She clasped her hands behind her back. "Look, but don't touch," Aunt Mandy always said. Ruth wanted her own store when she grew up, only it didn't have to be a bait shop. In fact, she thought she might prefer a dry goods store or a grocery or maybe a penny candy store, a place where the goods weren't alive and didn't make such a mess. What she wanted was a stock of items, all on their own special shelves, and a big case on the counter with lots of tiny drawers. She would know without looking what was in each one, the way Mrs. Lindgren did. Ruth liked the way you just had to wait, when you had a store, for people to come in and tell you what they'd been up to since the last time. She liked the account books, with their special columns for credits and debits, and the neat way Mrs. Lindgren made her numbers. Mrs. Lindgren was only good at writing the numbers, not at the adding and subtracting, so sometimes Imogene had to go over the figures for her. Imogene could do sums in her head faster than other people could write them down. Most of her other chores she hated. She only pretended to dust when she went around with the cloth, and whenever Mrs. Lindgren asked her and Ruth to clean out some of the tubs, she mainly just pumped the water and talked while Ruth did all the scrubbing. Ruth didn't mind. It was fun working, as long as Imogene was in a good mood, telling about the people they knew or what she'd done with her cousins up north. Ruth hoped she would get to work the register sometime, but Imogene said better not, her mother wouldn't like it. After their bloody afternoon 2 years before, Imogene had sought Ruth out, as was her right by virtue of her popularity, mostly because she was curious. She craved drama and expected Ruth to do and say unusual things. For the sake of the company, Ruth was clever enough to oblige. Even now, when curiosity had long since given way to familiarity, and familiarity had ripened into affection, Ruth still felt she'd better get Imogene interested, or soon enough she'd be saying Ruth might as well go home. Ruth picked up a knife with a flat, curved blade. "What's this for?" she asked, just to say something. It took a lot of effort sometimes to have Imogene for a friend. "Ugh, to take the scales off. I hate fish." Imogene said the last part quietly, so her mother, who was doing the bookkeeping in the back room, wouldn't hear her. Mrs. Lindgren always told Imogene that she should be grateful. Fish bought her dresses and hair ribbons, chicken dinners, train trips to Milwaukee, a warm house. It was a funny idea, Ruth thought, a perch standing on its tail with a shopping basket over one fin, choosing a nice piece of calico and 7 mother-of-pearl buttons at the dry goods store. Imogene went on lifting handfuls of sinkers and letting them fall back into their box through her fingers. And then Ruth thought of something to offer, something so big and important, she couldn't believe she hadn't already used it up. "Want to see where my mother's buried?" Imogene sat up straight. "Really?" She slid off the stool. "Sure, if you want to." Ruth said it like it was nothing, like she could show her 100 things just as interesting if she was in the mood. "We're going out, Mother," Imogene called toward the curtained doorway behind her. "Have a good time, girls. Don't be late," Mrs. Lindgren's voice came back. Ruth liked the way Mrs. Lindgren treated them, as if they were old enough to know what they were doing. So different from Aunt Mandy, who'd never stop fussing, even now that she was 14 and Imogene was nearly 11. Ruth didn't bother to walk all the way to the cemetery gate. Instead, when they reached the rock wall, she boosted herself onto it and swung her legs over. Imogene balked. "Ruth, anyone could see right up your dress." "So? Everyone here is dead." Ruth stood on the wall then and grabbed the branch of a pear tree that hung over her head. She walked up the trunk until she could hook her knees over the branch and hung there. "Don't worry. No one can tell it's me." Her voice was muffled by her skirt, which hung upside down over her face. "Ruth, please," Imogene said, but she giggled and scrambled onto the wall herself. "Help me up." Too short to reach the branch on which Ruth was now sitting, she held her arms as high as she could over her head and scratched the air with her fingertips, waiting. Ruth leaned precariously toward her, supporting first herself and then both of them by hooking her instep under another branch.
She wasn't strong enough, however, to pull Imogene up. "I have to let go," she said, and dropped her onto the soft cemetery grass. "Come down, then," Imogene demanded. "Let's go." Usually, Ruth didn't like visiting the graveyard. Walking up the gravelly path with Amanda, her feet always slipping a little back for every step forward, it had always seemed too hot or too cold. She'd felt sorry for her mother and her grandparents, too, stuck there. 12 back, 6, 7, and 8 in, baking or freezing, nothing to see. Even though she knew dead people, being in heaven, didn't care about those things. Today, though, scuffing through the grass with Imogene, the place felt different, like a playground. "Look at this one," Imogene said, stopping in front of the stone with the ship carved on it. "He was a sea captain," Ruth said, importantly. "He drowned, like my mother." In fact, she had no idea why Albert Morgan had a ship on his stone, but she didn't think he'd mind her making up a story about him. "And here are the ones from the war." That part was true. Aunt Mandy had told her.
"This is a baby."
Imogene read the dates on the stone in front of her, and they looked for more children, thinking what it would be like to be already under the ground forever, eaten by worms. "But their souls go to heaven," Ruth said. "Aunt Mandy told me all children's souls go to heaven. Everyone knows that." Ruth. When we found my mother's stone with the thick green honeysuckle growing behind it, I was almost sorry I'd brought Imogene there. You shouldn't visit your dead mother just to impress your bored friend. I traced the letters in my mother's name, hoping she'd believe I'd just come to see her, hoping she'd forgive me.
"That's funny," Imogene said.
"What is?"
"She died on my birthday, November 27th.
Same year, too." We looked at each other. It was a strange idea, frightening somehow, as if for a moment the door between the world of the living and the world of the dead had blown open. "Maybe you're her, reincarnated," I said for a joke to push the scariness away.
"What's reincarnated?"
I explained what Rudy had told me about a soul getting a new body when it died, about how you could have another life as a completely different person, or even as a cat or a goldfinch, and about how a person living a long time ago could be born again as you. Not that Rudy and I really believed it, although after Rudy told me, I looked for my mother whenever an animal was born on the farm. None of them seemed to know me as I knew my mother would, and obviously neither did Imogene. As we walked back into town, we talked about what we'd be in later lives and what we might have been before. "I'm sure I must have been someone famous," Imogene said. "At least once or twice. Maybe Pocahontas. Everyone says I must have Indian blood in me. My hair is so dark and both my parents are blonde." "That's not how it works. When you come back, you don't look anything like the person you were. It's not like you're related." And then, because I wished I hadn't shared my mother with her, I said, "What makes you think you were someone special, anyway? It's much more likely you were just ordinary. There are a lot more ordinary people than famous ones, you know." I said it mean, and I meant it mean, and I waited for her to be angry. But Imogene was too sure of herself to let anything I said upset her. "Oh, I'm positive we were both famous," she said. She stopped, grabbed my arm, turned me toward her, and stared at my face without blinking. "I know what you were," she said finally. "You were a Chinese spy. Your eyes have that little slant, and you're always so quiet watching people. You know things, but you don't tell." She smiled, pleased with her story. I didn't know anything, though. I only thought it seemed very strange that, while my mother and I were drowning, Imogene was being born. When Ruth opened the kitchen door, Amanda looked up from the brilliant red rhubarb stem she was dicing. "Where have you been all day? You knew the beans needed weeding and the potato plants are full of bugs, and I bet you the birds ate a good dozen tomatoes." Ruth sighed. She wished things would stop growing. That was another good thing about a store. Everything stayed steady, just as it was. "I'll do it now," she said, turning to go back out. "You'll be eaten alive out there at this hour. There's a proper time for things." In one hand, Amanda held 5 rhubarb stalks together on the table. With the other, she wielded a long knife. "Anyway," she said, slicing quickly through the crisp stalks while she slid her fingers along just fast enough to escape the knife, "I already did it for you. Ruth, ashamed of herself, looked at the floor. Dad said I could go. Well, no use crying over spilt milk. Wash up and I'll give you a ruby. Ruth worked the pump handle and began to wash her hands. Maybe, Amanda said quietly, you'd like to bring Imogene over here. What? Ruth pretended she couldn't make out the words over the squeak of the pump and the rush of the water. Amanda dipped a piece of the rhubarb in sugar. I said, why don't you bring Imogene over here? Ruth held out the back of her hand so Amanda could balance the rhubarb on her finger like the jewel in a ring. It was their joke from some long-ago time of childish misunderstandings. Wouldn't it be fun, all three of us here together? Don't you like being here with me? Yes, Ruth said. But the truth was, she did and she didn't. As she chewed her rhubarb, she felt Amanda's love, insidious and irresistible, press around her in the hot kitchen, and she pursed her lips and squinted her eyes at the mix of sour and sweet. For the first time, she realized that she liked Imogene partly because her friend had nothing to do with Amanda. Carl sat on the floor in one of the bedrooms of the island house, drawers pulled from the dresser spread out around him. An oblong of light fell across the floor from between the boards he'd pried off the window. He'd been through all of these drawers and the cupboards and the interstices between the walls and under the floorboards many times before. For months now, he'd been rowing out to the island, sometimes once a week, sometimes every day, to look. It was like riding a Ferris wheel. One day he would be relaxed, untroubled, sure that Amanda's story was true. She and Matilda had lived on the island because they loved it there, because Matilda wanted to be in the house she'd shared with him. And then the doubts would begin, and the uncertainties would build, until at last he would have to drop whatever he was doing and hurry single-mindedly to the house to search for clues of something else. He tried to stay away. What if you find something, he said to himself, then what? Nothing good can come of it. Concentrate on your work. But he neglected the farm, thinking of one more spot he hadn't checked, vividly imagining the white edge of a folded love letter or the golden glint of a keepsake ring. Some man had seduced his wife. Carl had suspected it now for more than 6 months. He had merely to find the evidence. He'd discovered only one clue. He pulled the silver knife out of his pocket, as he did several times a day now, and examined it. It was a good knife, expensive, not something casually left behind by someone building the house. Besides, he knew everyone who had worked on the house, and none of their initials matched these, C.J.O. This had belonged to some other man. So what if it had, he told himself, and told himself, and told himself. It might mean nothing. It probably meant nothing. But then how to explain Amanda's reaction when he showed the knife to her? He played over and over in his mind the morning he'd run across in his sock drawer the knife he'd picked up years before, when he and Joe and Ruth had been to the island together. He'd laid it on the table at breakfast, asking Amanda if she knew who owned it, thinking he ought to return a valuable object like that. She grabbed it up, turned it over, and then immediately pushed it back at him. I don't know. How should I know? The junk that collects. You should see the stuff I found behind the icebox last week. She'd picked up his plate before he'd finished his breakfast and scraped the last few bites of egg into the slop bucket, muttering, I can't be held responsible for every odd pocket knife that turns up in a drawer. At the time, it didn't even occur to Carl that Amanda's behavior might have anything to do with Matilda. In the first place, his sister-in-law was always high-strung and quick to take offense, so her reaction hardly seemed unusual. And in the second place, he'd nearly forgotten about his wife. At least he'd packed her away somehow. He was ashamed to admit it, but when he thought of her lately, it seemed almost as if she'd been married to some other man, a friend he'd once known well, but had long since lost track of. He missed her with a sense of nostalgia, in much the same way he missed his own youth, and even when he tried, he couldn't find a trace of the unbearable agony and black despair that had once overwhelmed him. He was sorry for Matilda because she'd lost so much of life, and he was sorry for Ruth that she couldn't know her mother. But for a long time now, he'd forgotten to feel sorry for himself. But then he'd heard Matilda's voice. He heard it first in the barn, just a snatch, a word or two,
Or maybe not even an entire word, but a piece of a word and an inflection. A note that was so unmistakably familiar that he said, "Matilda?" aloud without thinking, and looked toward the hayloft, certain she must be sitting there, yellow straw tangled in her dark hair, her feet swinging as she smiled down at him. Of course she wasn't. Of course she'd not come back to life. Still, he knew she was there somewhere. He strained to hear more, but the voice was gone, drowned out by Ruth calling the geese to their supper. The second time Carl heard Matilda's voice, he was placing a salt lick near the spring. This time it was much more distinct. It was singing Lavender's Blue, and seemed to be coming from among a clump of cattails. Although he knew it was only a memory, somehow released with intense clarity within his head, although he knew there would be nothing to see but air, he couldn't help but follow the sound, his feet sinking with every step into the rich, inky marsh soil. Gingerly he parted the stiff stalks of the cattails and their sharp leaves to find the singer looking at him. "Hello, Daddy. Look at all the mallow I've got for Aunt Amanda." Carl lost his footing and slipped to his knees. After that, it seemed that almost everything Ruth did reminded him of Matilda. The way she raised her eyebrows when she talked, the way she held her head as she studied her lessons, the way she sat with her legs tucked underneath her, the way she splayed her fingers wide when making an emphatic point. He wanted to grab her hands and squeeze those fingers together. Instead, he frowned and looked away. That was when he took the knife back out of his sock drawer again. Turning the silver over and over in his hands, trying the blade against the ball of his thumb for sharpness, he found himself puzzling over Hilda's implications years before. Why would two young women choose to live alone on an island? Why did they stay on through the fall? Rudy was no help. Carl cornered him one evening in the tack room. "I tried to get them girls to come home, Carl," Rudy said, rubbing hard on the bridle he was oiling. "I rode out there, I told her, 'You girls better come on back now. It's getting cold.'"
"What do you mean you told her? Who did you tell?"
"Well," Rudy stared at the bit as if trying to see an image of the past in the shiny metal. "It was Maddie, I guess, I told. I never saw Amanda much, or just to wave to, up on the porch. I don't see what's the difference. What one did, the other did, this kind of thing."
"This kind of thing? You mean they'd done this before?"
"Not like this, not living there. But when they were younger, that's where they'd go. A beeline for that island whenever Mrs. Starkey got on them about something at the house. We had one hell of a time finding them, me and Mr. Starkey, before we caught on. Of course, he'd give them hell for running away, especially Manda. You know, she was older, she should have known better, that kind of thing. But he liked it, too, the way they stuck together. 'I never had a brother,' he said to me, and I knew what he meant." Carl was impatient with this sort of reminiscence. "But this time, Rudy, when they were living there, what did Maddie say when you told her it was time to move back to the farm?"
"Ah, you know how Maddie was, Carl. Not even Mr. Starkey could get her to do anything she didn't want to do. 'No, Rudy, we like it here,' that's what she said. And she and the little one did look good and healthy. In fact, I'd say she gained a little, rounded out some. So I knew nothing was wrong. Now, if I'd have talked to Amanda, it might have been different. She's a good girl. She'll do what you say. But you know how Maddie was. She went and put her hands on her hips and shook that pretty head. She wouldn't hardly let me get out of the boat."
Rudy clucked his tongue and turned at last to hang the bridle on its hook. Weak old man, Carl thought, letting a couple of girls tell him what to do. But he knew in Rudy's place, he would have done the same. When Rudy turned back to face him, there were tears in his eyes.
"I know what I should have done, Carl. I've thought of it plenty of times before. I should have grabbed Ruthie. If I'd have took Ruthie back before the ice come in, then they'd have come after her, and none of this would have happened. I should have thought of that, I tell myself. Every day, I tell myself."
"It's all right, Rudy," Carl said, putting a comforting hand on the old man's shoulder. "Amanda was right. No use crying over what couldn't be changed." She wouldn't let him get out of the boat. That's what stood out to Carl when he thought about this conversation later. Why not? Why not give him a cup of coffee, a piece of kuchen? What were they doing on that island, Carl wondered, that they didn't want Rudy to see? For a week or so it baffled him,
couldn't think of any explanation that made sense. And then he remembered Madame Poker. It had hardly been a village, that place he'd stumbled on with McKinley and Sims one gray afternoon. A few dirty huts, an empty pigsty, a church without a steeple, one wall blown in. It couldn't have been much to look at before the war, and now it was just a jumble of abandoned stone. Or not quite abandoned. Henny Sims came running from behind one of the houses, buttoning his pants. "There's a man in there! Jesus! At least I think it's a man!" Just then an old woman appeared at the door. Her back bent so far she had to crane her neck to look up at them, her gray hair standing around her head like a halo. She spoke French, and McKinley translated. "He's mine," she said. "You can't have him. I'm keeping him. He's mine." And then she lifted what Carl had taken to be a cane, but was in fact a poker, and held it in both hands, point toward them, as if it could keep the three armed men at bay. The Americans looked at each other, and Sims shrugged. "He's not much anyway," he said, "from what I could see. I think he's missing an ear, at least." "Let's let the fellow be," Carl said, eager to get away from the place. "All right by me," McKinley agreed. "Anybody desperate enough to live with that ought to be allowed to desert." No one could be more unlike the crone than Matilda, but Carl suddenly realized that she and Amanda and that old woman had all been up to the same thing. Although while poor Madame Poker was hiding a Frenchman, pushed by years of war to the brink of insanity and perhaps beyond, Matilda and Amanda were harboring a plain old American shirker, a man who would let others, like Carl himself, go off and do the dirty work for him, risk their lives while he lazed about letting two women take care of him. Carl made a fist around the silver pocket knife and slammed it hard against the table. They'd been hiding a shirker. A shirker whose initials were C.J.O. It was an impossible leap, and at the same time a simple step from the notion of a strange man hidden in the island house to the certainty that that shirker had loved Matilda. Had she loved him back? Of course not. She had been kind to him, misguidedly thinking she was doing right, perhaps even hoping that someone would do the same for Carl if necessary. Of course she hadn't loved him. But the thought itched and stung. Love made you do things, Amanda had said, and then you were sorry. What did she mean? He worried the idea, tugging at it like a hangnail little by little, until he drew blood, until he had to find out one way or another, until he found himself again in the island house, prying up the floorboards, opening the window frames, rummaging through every drawer, searching for the evidence. Finally, the force that had propelled Carl all afternoon began at last to ebb, and he fitted the drawers he'd spread around the bedroom back into the dresser. He felt spent, suddenly calm, knowing that he was wasting his time, that all had been innocent on the island, that there had only been an accident, an unlucky accident, one cold November night. He felt foolish now, as he always did after one of these episodes, and he glanced over his shoulder, superstitiously sensing that someone might be watching, Matilda maybe, and laughing at his frenzy. He left the house and rowed back slowly across the water, resting on his oars from time to time to let the fresh afternoon wind dry his skin. Poor Maddie, to have lost all these years and years of glorious summer days. "Elbows off the table, Ruth," Amanda said, passing a plate of white bread to the girl. "How many times do I need to tell you?" Carl kept his eyes on his plate. He knew that he ought to correct Ruth more often, not leave it all to Amanda, but he hadn't even noticed the girl's elbows. "This ham is excellent," he said. "I'm glad you like it. I knew you'd need a good meal after those ditches." Carl shifted in his seat. "As a matter of fact, I didn't do the digging. Pass the potatoes, Ruth. We watered the new trees in the orchard today." Amanda's knife made a sharp click as she set it on the edge of her plate. "I thought I explained the importance of those ditches, Carl." She tapped her index finger on the tabletop. "My father always made sure the ditches were clean the first week of June, and we're already into the third week now. What if we get a big rain? The field will be standing in water."
"But what if we don't? Those saplings are just drying up out there."
"Carl, you have to think ahead on a farm.
You can't just be running from one emergency to another. You'll never get anywhere that way. What happened to that baby? Ruth said suddenly. She held her fork in the air, a beet slice skewered on the tines. No one responded for a moment, as Amanda and Carl decided whether they were relieved or annoyed to be distracted from their argument.
What baby?
Rudy finally asked.
More tomatoes, Rudy?
Amanda held out the plate.
The baby we took to its mother, Ruth said.
How did it get lost?
A lost baby, Carl said. Who loses a baby?
She must be talking about a lamb, Amanda said.
I'm not talking about a lamb. It was a baby, and it was crying, so we brought it to its mother.
The stork brings the baby to the mother, Rudy said.
No, Ruth said. We did. Aunt Amanda and me.
Aunt Amanda and I, Amanda corrected.
Maybe you read it, Carl said, in a book.
That girl, always the book, Rudy said.
This wasn't in a book, Ruth said.
She pushed her beets around her plate, painting with their pink juice.
Are you sure? Amanda said. Because I know sometimes when I read a story and then I dream about it, when I wake up, I'm not sure what I've read and what I've dreamed and what really happened.
Ruth put her elbow on the table, her chin in her hand. She looked over her shoulder at the floor, away from the rest of them.
It was a real baby, she said sullenly.
I remember walking with you when you were just a bitty baby. You must have had colic, something terrible, because you cried and cried, Rudy said.
Ruth frowned at Rudy.
No, I didn't. I did not cry.
Amanda's chair scraped back from the table. She grabbed Ruth by the back of the collar and stood her on her feet.
You apologize to Rudy this instant, Ruth Sapphira Newman.
Ruth hid her face in her hands.
I'm sorry, Rudy. I'm sorry I shouted at you.
That's all right, sweetheart. He winked at her.
Now you go to your room, Amanda said. She followed Ruth out of the kitchen and watched her climb the stairs.
Ruth, she said when the girl reached the top.
Ruth stopped but didn't look back.
I'll save you some pie.
Chapter 10 Amanda.
Swim,
the little voice piped just beside my ear. Swim,
swim.
I opened my eyes to see Ruthie standing beside my bed, just as she had every morning for the past 2 weeks.
Let's go swimming, she announced and clapped her hands.
All right, sweetie, shh, yes, we'll swim.
I pulled her into the bed with me. It was the middle of July now, and so hot that even the sheet over my shoulder made me sweat and kept me from falling asleep at night. It seemed I'd closed my eyes only an hour before.
Let's sleep another minute.
But Ruthie wouldn't stay still. She bounced on the mattress and wriggled in my arms, and the word swim burst from her in a whisper every few seconds. Finally, I gave up. At least the water would cool us.
Be quiet, Ruthie. You'll wake your mother, I said, struggling to pin up my braid.
Shh, shh, she said, jumping up and down on the bed and clapping her hands again. I went to her and held out my arms, and she leaped into them with a tremendous squeal. I carried her out of the house and down to the water. We swam, although you could hardly call what I did in the water swimming, in our night clothes, since Ruth had no bathing costume, and mine wouldn't have fit me, even if I'd thought to pack it along. We played a while in the shallows, me sitting on the lake bottom, letting the cool water lap over the tops of my thighs and around my waist. Ruth squatting, getting her bottom wet, but keeping her knees dry. I trailed my arms through the water and patted cool handfuls around my neck. Ruth splashed, wetting us both, thrilled with the sensation of flinging something her fingers couldn't hold, and with the sight of the scattering droplets. Then she laid her palms gently on the water, testing the surface tension before plunging her hands under, where she studied her fingers, which no longer seemed related to the ones she knew in dry air. She grabbed for pretty rocks and laughed when she came up with only a fistful of water, because the stones were so much deeper than they appeared. Soon she would wander farther out, and I would have to scramble after her. By the time the water was above my knees, she would almost be swimming. I would support her tight little tummy with my palm, but she hardly needed my help. She kept herself afloat, paddling like a turtle, her neck straining to hold her chin above the water, her feet pumping wildly behind. Always at some point, she'd scoot away from me. She'd move a little distance and then stop, checking to see if I'd noticed. I'd look away, pretending I didn't see, until she made her way under the willow whose vines hung down to the water.
"Where's Ruth?" I called, and her laugh would come from the tree. "I wonder where Ruthie could be." Finally, I'd pull back the drapery of leaves and grab her up, and we'd struggle through the water to the shore. This morning, Matilda was standing in the doorway. I set Ruthie down on the beach, and she went running toward her mother. Matilda didn't look at her, though. She stared at me as I stood there, my nightgown plastered against my middle. When I was 14 and Matilda was 6, she burst into our room one morning as I was dressing. I had been careful around that time to be sure she was safely downstairs or fast asleep before I changed my clothes. But on that day, she caught me. My nightgown was already over my head, and my dress was all the way across the room. She stopped in the door.